colonial area. Missions became rather colonial themselves. But this wasn't that. This was the world in which they moved, and there was no other way. We hear criticism these days, for instance, that missionaries should have moved into the city and started in the city. Now, I ask you, what cities existed in Africa many years ago? Just think about it. There weren't any. That's just the plain truth. There weren't any. Missionaries arrived in Lobito Bay in Angola and in Benguela and places like that where there was nothing more than anchorages off the coast. And they took a small longboat into the beach or a small jetty perhaps coming out. And that was all that was there. Trading post perhaps and a few Africans around, and there was nothing else. They moved into the bush. Now how are you going to establish yourself in the bush? You certainly can't rent a house in the city. You have to, first of all, if you move in with your wife, maybe a child or two, your family needs some decent drinking water. How are you going to get it? You have to make arrangements. You have to have shelter for them. You have to build a little house. It may have been only a mud hut, but at least it was a house, and you tried to improve it for your family's sake and for health's sake. There was malaria around, so you tried to do what you could about mosquitoes. And by the way, there was no antibiotics. This became a real problem. There were black water fever and all sorts of difficulties. During the early days of missions in Africa, particularly in West Africa, along this coast here, 4 out of 5 that went to Africa never came back to their first furlough because they died. Died of black water fever. Died of malaria, died of plague of one sort or another. No, and they kept coming. Talk about commitment. These people knew what it was. And they had to set up rather bushy mission stations set up in order to exist at all. Even at that, 4 out of 5 of them didn't make it. Now, let's not be too critical of brethren that went by when in the early days, there was simply no other way to go. And they did a tremendous job against tremendous odds. I think we ought to take our hats off to the past. The fact that there are still a few rather colonial-type missionaries around today is just the end of a changing era. And some of these dear old brethren cannot change in their own attitudes too much, but things are changing all over Africa, and of course we ought to be aware of these changes in our own view as the people of God. So that we're talking about these 10 countries in southern Africa. South Africa, what's known as Southwest Africa, in between them is Botswana, what used to be known as Botswanaland, and then Mozambique, the former Portuguese colony on the east coast of Africa, Angola, the Portuguese colony, or former Portuguese colony. In fact, it never was a colony as such, it was part of Portugal. Now, on the west coast of Africa, and in between these two colonies are Rhodesia and Zambia, which used to be known as Northern and Southern Rhodesia, and Malawi, a long, thin country that comes down between these and Mozambique. Within South Africa, there are two new little nations, one known as Swaziland and the other as Lesotho, or Lesotho-land, with its former name. These people are perhaps 100 million people in totem, and there are many tribes and many different languages that are spoken. There are other minority groups besides Africans. There are whites. There are East Indians. Particularly along the coast of Africa, one of the phenomena of Africa is that there are East Indians and Lebanese and Syrians and so on all down the eastern coast of Africa and to some extent along the west coast of Africa as well. They moved in the early days to do trading, and they're still there. Of course, they have multiplied, and there are many of them. In Durban, for instance, here where we lived for many years, there are about 500,000 Indians, that is, East Indians, from India. And there's good work. There's even an assembly work going on there, something like. There are 3 assemblies, of East Indians there, and the work is growing very, very remarkably. There are many tribes and a number of minorities. Besides these whites and besides the Indians, there are Bushmen. Bushmen live in the desert areas of Southwest Africa and down here in the western part of the Cape or the Cape province in South Africa. These people are quite unlike Negroid or Bantu, a word sometimes used. It really is only refers to language groups, but is often used in regard to people. Quite different than the rest of the Bantu or Negroid peoples that occupy the whole southern two-thirds of Africa. Not exclusively, but they certainly do exclusively here, except for these small Bushmen tribes. There's a change coming. Is everybody laughing at me?
Since the money is taller.
In the beginning, it began with colonialism, and it sort of degenerated along these headings. First of all, there was discovery, that is, the lands, western lands, usually Portugal, France, Spain, Britain, and so on, discovered these lands, and then there was development. They developed them largely for their own purposes, but along with their own purposes, cities began to develop, health began to improve, industry began to appear, jobs began to come, and so on. There was development, then there was discrimination between the European powers and the Africans that were there. And there certainly was a difference between this. Because of discrimination, there began to be, in the first part of this century and on toward the present and still up to the present, demonstration. Local people demonstrating for what they believed to be equal rights and fair opportunities and so on. And because of this, since the war, there have been so-called democracies. Now, I should have put this word in quotes. In fact, there is not a single operating democracy as you think of it. A thousand thanks, sir. In the whole continent of Africa, they call them democracies, they call them majority rule, but they're not. In fact, there has usually been one election, usually rigged anyway, and then so-called government set up. Within two or three years, this is taken over by a military regime and ruled by a dictator until the present. This is the way practically every African country has gone. Democracy, then, is a weak sort of word. Then this has been taken over by disaster and dictatorship, which is the rule for most countries now, and I don't mean to say that Africa is not run at all. They have reasonably stable governments. The truth is that Africa, at its present stage, is much better ruled by dictatorship than it is by democracy. They're used to a very authoritative type of thing. They look up to one man, and whether you call it democracy or call it something else, in fact, one man with his bureaucracy under him and down to chiefs and headmen and down to the people is the way that Africans understand authority. And providing you get a reasonably decent man at the top, you'll have a reasonably decent government. There are some countries with very poor men at the top, like Uganda, for instance, with Amin. But in general, it's working at least a little bit. So that you get a dictatorship, which is largely what is running Africa today. The last one, in order to keep these dear alliterative brethren happy, we have the dread influence. Now, I didn't spell dread properly because it has to do with communist dread influence coming in. And it is also D-R-E-A-D, and many of the countries, perhaps about one a year, are going communist in their orientation. So that this is what's happening politically in Africa. There are current trends as well. The trends we ought, as Christians, to be aware of. Now, Islam is on the march. Coming down through Africa from north to south with a very large push. Islam is a missionary religion. And they have large amounts of money, largely centered in the Al-Ahram University in Cairo, where they're training over 2,000 Muslim missionaries to go down largely into Africa and parts of the Middle East and other places in Southern Europe and promote Islam there. It's a very growing force. We can't take time with that today. It doesn't really affect Southern Africa yet. There's a growing communist influence, and communists are moving into country after country, first of all with economic aid, then with military assistance. They move in their own spies, they try to promote unrest, and then take over in the middle of the melee that follows this. Tribalism is very strong. Now, you cannot think of Africa without thinking of tribalism. And what will eventually be the undoing, I think, of communism, as well as other influences in Africa, is this very thing of tribalism. It's very strong. You think of Angola, but it has three main tribes in it, and those three tribes are not likely to see eye to eye in your generation or in the next one, unless somebody forces it at gunpoint. And it's the same in Rhodesia. There are two main tribes there, and great things may happen in Rhodesia, but between the Ndebeles and the Shonas, there is not likely to be peace. Not likely to be peace. And it'll be a long, long time. And this is the case right through Africa. In Burundi, that we were praying for this morning, you'll have the Hutus and the what's the other main tribe there? The one that's in power? Watusi. Thank you. I knew we had brains somewhere in the audience. You have the Hutus and the Watusis, and these are irreconcilably opposed to one another, and thousands, tens of thousands of people have been killed in the last few years. Now the, one of these tribes, I think it's the Watusis, are in power, aren't they? And the Hutus are held down, but at gunpoint. The only way tribalism seems to be stabilized in Africa. Now, this is the true right through Africa. Tribalism is very strong, and you must take this into account when you think of Africa. Urbanization is the next thing. That is, people moving to cities. 100 years ago, there virtually were no cities. But today, there are large cities. Johannesburg has, a million and a half. And you go on up through some of these cities in Africa, and they're growing at tremendous rates. Sometimes in terrible squalor. Typical African city has several beautiful buildings, usually a very nice airport, usually a few roads from the airport into the city, and a Conrad Hilton Hotel, and a Sheraton Hotel, and a few other big business and government buildings, and then squalor from there on. But these cities are growing, and the influence for Africa is going to take place in the cities in the future. There's economic dependence. That is, they're dependent on the West for factories, for business, for other such things. I'm not going to go into these things. I'm just giving to them quickly as a rundown on the situation there. There is political instability. Governments that appear stable today may be taken over by another military regime tomorrow. You've witnessed this in Nigeria, you've witnessed this in Ghana, you've witnessed this in numbers of African countries that have changed several times, but always in the terms of dictatorship and
military juntas that rule them. Christian trends. There are four here I've listed that are common today. Universalism is one of them. That is, that all Christians are the same, that we all belong under the World Council of Churches, and never mind what you believe, we're all good people and we're all going the same direction, the universal fatherhood of God, or the brotherhood of man, etc. Syncretism is a second one, that is the coalescence of old tribal beliefs, largely based on spirit worship, ancestor worship, and so on, and some Christian tradition, and melting them into one, and these two go together, universalism and syncretism. Then you have black theology coming in, which says that, in one sense that, well, they would put it something like this. The white man came to Africa, he told us about God, he told us about salvation, and he told us not to mind that we were not very well looked after, and we didn't have very much food, and we didn't have good hospitalization. And he told us to look up to our God, and so we looked up, and while he was looking up, he reached out his hand, and he grabbed all our oil, and our mineral, and our wood, and our palm nuts, and all the things that we had. And now, they said, we realize that we must not look up anymore, and we must look out. And forget these people who deceived us in the past. We have a black Christ and a black salvation and a black theology, and we're going to develop it around our own culture. There's a lot of ramifications to it, but this is at least one angle to black theology, and it rejects white skin, white Christ, and so on. Now, the fourth thing is the dearth of the teachers of the gospel. Within the truly evangelical church, I think the biggest need in Africa today are people who can teach the word. Africans make generally very good evangelists. They're enthusiastic. They make very good Christians. But not very many are capable as teachers in terms of being able to sit down or to stand up in front of an audience and teach systematically the word of God. So many, even when they go to Bible school, come out of Bible school and think, well, now I know it. That's it. And without much preparation, the tendency is to look about 5 minutes before the meeting for an odd verse or two in the Bible and get up and begin to talk. And when you run out and the time hasn't run out, you read the next few verses and say something about those, whatever happens to occur to you at the time. Now, this can be profitable. It can also be very tedious. And it's not too good. Pray for your brethren in Africa, that is the evangelical line of things, regarding the need for teachers, and this is true in most of Africa. Now, enough of that. We're talking about largely 10 countries in southern Africa. I think you see most of them here on the map, from Angola down to South Africa. Now, assembly mission work started coming in there around 100 years ago or so, and produced a pattern that looks something like this. The biggest bulk of them came in from the west coast on this part of Africa, from Lobito Bay and Benguela in Angola. They came up along the highlands of Angola and into what we now know as Zambia and the southern part of what was then the Belgian Congo, what is now Zaire. And there are dozens of mission stations. Every M on this map is for a mission station, an assembly mission station, in this area that became known as the Beloved Strip. And we can thank the Lord for tens of thousands of believers now that are in this area as a result of excellent work done by missionaries over the years. Across the center of Angola, into the northern part of Zambia, and into the southern part of Zaire. And this work has been a remarkable one and has been one of the assembly's chief areas in the continent of Africa. And names like Segeji and Chibombo and so on are commonly known. Chivuma and Zambezi and Chitokoloki. And there have been all sorts of names that have that mean a great deal to us, the Logans and so on, that have worked hard, and there are brethren that have followed that are still working hard in these areas. So that there has been quite a lot go on there. Then in other parts of these countries, virtually nothing in Mozambique, virtually nothing until a few years ago in Malawi, and virtually nothing in Rhodesia until a few years ago, when Crawford Allison and George Wiseman moved down there from Angola, as we heard the other day. It's only very recently that Botswana has started to have a work. Now, Botswana has a growing work in one place called Soroe. This may expand during the years that are to come. South Africa has had an older work and is a little spotty, but down on the southern coast of South Africa, in the Zulu country where we have been working, there are several mission stations and areas where work has been done among Zulu people there. Then in the Cape and in Port Elizabeth, there is a little bit, and up in the higher parts of South Africa. So that God has worked in these areas, and the assemblies have had a large share in it. Although, of course, other evangelical groups were there and are there, and we can thank God for them. Now today, there are things happening that it may be reasonably important to us. This goes on something like this, I guess. See if I can get my... No, that's not right. Here we are. But these green lines represent major railway lines in Africa. See if we can make it reach Cape down there. The top one ought to reach Lobito Bay. Does it? Anyway, never mind. The green lines represent major railway lines in Africa getting out of this area of Africa. I'm still not right. Somehow. Up. No, that's not right either, is it? Well, anyway, something like this. This should be, I suppose, mainly... Oh, that's better, isn't it? There I am. No, I was trying to reach Cape Town, and I guess I can't reach Cape Town. Okay, these railway lines represent the major routes out of the central part of southern Africa. Now, the great source of minerals are here in what's known as the Copper Belt, and down here around Johannesburg and so on. And the only way to get these minerals out of Africa by railway lines. There is one railway line goes up through the Zaire and down through Angola. There's one recently built by the Red Chinese out through Dar es Salaam to the east coast of Africa. There's one railway line down to Beira in Mozambique, and there's another railway line comes down through South Africa where it has a number of different outlets. Now the difficulty is that because of communist pressure, this railway line has been closed for years, at least 12 years. It was opened very briefly during this time, and sections of it work, but there is no direct route to get copper out of Zambia or along here in the southern part of Zaire, where there's also a lot of copper, because it's closed for one reason or another. The railway line down through Beira, the most direct and usual route through Rhodesia, has been closed by the communist countries that have taken over, powers that have taken over Mozambique going down there. So that railway line is out. The railway line going up through Dar es Salaam appeared to be an answer to the problem. They built it, but the backlog of trouble in Dar es Salaam is something like 8 or 9 months. So that if you want to ship things into Zambia that way, you've got problems. And if you want to ship copper out and are waiting for the money for it, you've got problems as well. So every major line is virtually tied up. There is a line that's not supposed to be open, running down through Victoria Falls, through Rhodesia, Bulawayo, and then down across Botswana and into South Africa. Now, presumably this is all shut, but at night it works very hard. And they take Rhodesian and South African things up into Zambia and into Zaire, and they take all the labels off the cans and that sort of thing, because they wouldn't admit that this is where they came from. But there is, in fact, a good deal of stuff going up this back door route. But the main problem is that the big routes are tied up. And, of course, they won't come down officially through South Africa at all. There is chromium, platinum, gold, titanium, and copper that are very important to Southern Africa. Besides that, 80% of Europe's oil comes down around the coast of Africa and up to Europe. I think something like 10% of our own oil comes around this way, too. But 80% of Europe's oil comes around here. You can stand on the coast of South Africa and see 200,000-ton tankers go by in strings all the time on their way to Europe. Every day, they can be seen. Now, because of the world monopoly, the Western world's monopoly on gold, on platinum, on chromium, and the large amounts of copper that are here, their mineral wealth is very, very valuable. Secondly, of course, they control a very vital link in oil coming around here. And it's for this reason that strategically the communist nations are trying to control Southern Africa. If you can control this sea route, you are controlling a very valuable link as far as Europe is concerned, and that they're angling for this. They talk about wanting freedom for the people. Of course, this is just a hoax. What they want is world domination for themselves. And this is largely what's happening. And the railway links form a basic part to all this sort of thing. So that there are lots of problems, and we can expect confrontations growing in Southern Africa as well. Politically, I think you're probably reasonably well aware of what's going on, but let's just look at it again. In Angola, where there was a war a couple of 3 years ago, there were three main movements, political movements, backed by the three tribes there. As you know, our country played a very disastrous part in it. We stopped what might have been a much better situation. And the MPLA, or the communist-backed one of the three movements, were the eventual victors in Angola. There is still fighting going on in many of the southern parts. UNITA, one of the political groups there, disappeared into the bush, but are fighting a great deal in southern and western Angola. By the way, it doesn't appear that UNITA has anything to do with the invasion of Zaire a few weeks ago. But this was done by a bunch of Katangan rebels from an old war about a dozen years ago. That appears to be almost finished. But the end result now is that refugees are pouring down into Southwest Africa. Some are going into Zambia, largely women and children. The men have been killed off. And the MPLA has quite a program of extermination of men belonging to other political groups or other tribes than they are. Angola is in quite a mess. Now, it's still possible across the central part of Angola to operate, and that's why our missionaries can still be there, and we need to thank God for at least a reasonable degree of safety and the ability to contact Africans there. Tremendous things have happened in that land. Thousands of Christians up in the northern areas there in Shinjiland, have come to know Christ as Savior, and they have conferences of 1,000 or 1,500 people and not a missionary around, going on right now. We can be thankful for a real movement of the Spirit of God in that part of the world. Politically, SWAPO, the Southwest Africa People's Organization, is the communist-backed political organization trying to take over South Africa, and they're due shortly to have an election and probably will be taking over, much against South Africa's will, reasonably shortly. In Mozambique, it's also been taken over by the Frelimo, another communist organization, and Samora Machel is the head of that state. In Rhodesia, there are arrows pointing all around it. That's the hot spot at the moment. And these arrows represent terrorist activity that are pressing in from almost all the way around poor old Rhodesia. From Botswana a little, from Zambia, and largely from Mozambique. And these are creating a very dangerous situation within Rhodesia. Not safe to go out in most of it at night anymore. And the big cities of Salisbury and Bulawayo are living in somewhat of fear for what's going to happen. There's supposed to be an election there in 2 or 3 months' time, and it will be very interesting, and we ought to pray regarding the effect it has on the people of God. The communist activity is directed in southern Africa from Lusaka in Zambia. There's a Russian gentleman there by the name of Vasily Solodovnikov, who is probably the most clued up man in the world on Africa, and he is supposedly the foreign affairs advisor there in Lusaka. He is in fact directing the activities of most of these communist-backed people's organizations, political organizations in the southern part of Africa. And we need to watch this very, very carefully. He's not a man that you'll find in the news very often, but his influence is enormous and has a great deal to say about what's happening. So that the end result is that communist influence is growing in southern Africa. The more red these countries are, the more red they are. In other words, the closer together these lines are, the more they are controlled. Angola is virtually controlled, although there's still fighting going on there by the MPLA and Mr. Neto, who is the leader of Angola. Mozambique is communist controlled by Simona Michelle and the Frelimo groups there. Zambia, while not a communist nation and still quite wide open as far as the West is concerned, certainly leans toward communist help. And there are dozens, if not hundreds, of Russian teachers in the schools. And we can see that Zambia is in for trouble coming in the future. Pray for Zambia. Pray for the dozens of assembly missionaries that are working in that land. Botswana is largely a desert land. Most of it, except for a strip along here, is desert. But, and has maybe 600,000 or 700,000 people total in the whole country. But there is a work there, and it is being influenced of necessity because of pressure from all around, and will be under the gun, no doubt. Although the Seretse Khama, who is the leader there, is a reasonably balanced man. But he certainly leans towards the communist side of things. Rhodesia is bravely trying to hold out with racial policies, with which some of you may not agree, but the result of whatever will happen in Rhodesia will probably be far worse than anything that's there now. It's a lovely country. It's a great shame to see it headed for trouble that appears to be reasonably shortly coming. South Africa is also under the gun, but will follow Rhodesia and Southwest Africa in terms of communist strategy. South Africa, unlike both these other two lands, is very strong and very wealthy, and there are pretty close to 5 million whites that have an attitude just like the Israelis. They have nowhere to go, and they don't intend to go anywhere. And when it comes to confrontation in South Africa, it will be a very, very costly thing in terms of carnage in human life, because the South Africans intend to stay, and they intend to keep up their policies, whether we agree with them or not. And we need to pray for South Africa. I don't think this is coming in the very near future. South Africa is very strong. But eventually, in the climate of the world today, it will come, and there'll be problems there. These are, however, don't think that South Africa is on its way down the drain tomorrow. It certainly is not. It'll be here 10 years from now, in my estimation, and it may be here a lot longer than that. So that gives at least a general overview of what's happening there. What's going to happen in the future? Well, I think that urban violence in South Africa and some of these other cities will probably increase. I think that we'll have continued trouble with tribalism, and probably the undoing of red influence in southern Africa will be this very thing of tribalism, for they're not able to control it any better than anybody else. And you just can't get the three tribes in Angola, or the two tribes in Rhodesia, or the several tribes in Zambia to get together very well at all. They have great animosity between themselves. And, of course, there are different tribes, the Zulus, the Xhosas, the Shangas, and so on, in South Africa, and these remain separate. Matter of fact, this is the backbone of South Africa's policy of separation, believing that the Zulus will be happier living in a Zulu homeland, the Xhosas happier in a Xhosa homeland, and put them all together, let them govern themselves there. This is probably not possible in the climate of the world today, but it might have had a better chance of success than what's happening in other parts of Africa. So that this is largely what's going on. There is anti-white feeling developing throughout southern Africa, and of course what used to be white superiority now often becomes a black superiority, and if you're a white, you haven't a chance, and you go to the back of all the lines. And you get last waited on, and so on. The very thing that used to happen to the African is now happening to the white. And this can be very irksome to whites, particularly if they're used to life in this country. Many of them have to learn to get along with things that they didn't know a great deal about before. Africans themselves in southern Africa don't like to be associated with whites because of their own relationships with their own people. I think of a man, his name was and his very fine brother, Abednego Msibi, grew up in Transvaal in South Africa here, and he's very well educated. He speaks English better than I do, or as well as I do. He's a very fine and a very clever man. He was offered a position with a Scripture Union, which is an organization that works among youth and college groups and so on within South Africa and its cities there. And eventually he refused, although the offer was a very good one. And he refused on the basis of the fact that if I sit down in Soweto — Soweto are African suburbs of Johannesburg, means southwestern township, Soweto, not a city or anything, just an abbreviation, Soweto. If I went to Soweto, where there are a million or more Africans, that I would spend all evening arguing why the head office of the organization with which I work is in Elof Street, one of the main streets in Johannesburg, with a white man at the top of it. He says, if I go in as an individual, I don't have to explain any of that. I can talk to them about the Savior I love and explain to them the claims of the gospel upon them. And so he didn't take the job, because it would be an embarrassment to him to be associated with whites. This is one of the reasons why we left Durban, a city on the the coast of South Africa here, where there are large numbers of blacks, but where there is great feeling on the city urban locations against white influence. And we become an embarrassment to our Africans. Not that they don't like to talk to us or we to them, but that having been seen associated with whites, they find it hard to witness to their neighbors and friends. Oh, you're the people that go to that white church, and whites represent the government, and the government supposedly is against us. Therefore, they won't listen. And they would be better, and perhaps for the time being anyway, are better on their own. Now, this is not true in country areas where most of our missionaries are working, but it certainly is true in the big cities: Durban, Johannesburg, Pretoria, Cape Town, Bloemfontein, Port Elizabeth, East London, and so on. So that urban violence probably is going to increase. Terrorism, which is now plaguing Rhodesia and in parts of other countries, will no doubt move south into South Africa and be troubled there. Probably from Mozambique, maybe from Botswana, and maybe from these little countries of Lesotho and Swaziland that are there. We need to pray. Pray for adaptability and wisdom for our missionaries that are there in a changing situation. Pray for wisdom for the Africans that are under pressure to become politically involved. And you'd be surprised how strong the pressures can be for Africans to join in with this, just as they're being pressed right now in the Congo to join in with this ECZ movement. And this virtually will mean that they'll join in with the political situation of the government. And by the way, if you think ahead, if the government in Congo changes and you were hired by the former government, which was the enemy of the now one that's now come in, where are you as a Christian? You're now the enemy. So that there are lots of ramifications to this kind of thing. And Africans need to need our prayers in regard to this. The day of the missionary is not over. Not over. Don't write off missionaries. Don't write off Southern Africa or any other part of Africa. There are plenty of areas where there are wide opportunities for missions today, and these ought to be, we ought to move in. Because of what might happen in 10 years, let's not quit today. Missions have always fought against odds. It wasn't easy for Paul right in the very beginning. It wasn't easy in the beginnings of missionaries and missions in Africa, or Latin America, or Asia, or China. Think of the numbers of times that China has closed and opened and closed and opened, or Japan, or Korea, or Southeast Asia, or other countries like this. There are grand opportunities, and let's be involved in this very thing. Now, there are a few minutes for questions. If so, Brother Harlow and other brethren here that will answer them gladly, I'm sure. Yes?
You have heard in the past where some parts of Africa have made many of the natives change their English names with tribal names now. That non-traditional tribal or other names. What kind of names would these people have to take upon themselves?
Oh, maybe something like Subanju or Iflato. This isn't, to my mind, an important thing at all. If they change my name to some other name, I don't think this makes much difference. They change the names of practically every colonial city in Africa. Instead of Leopoldville now, it's Kinshasa. Instead of Congo, it's now called Zaire. Instead of, you know, all these names are changing. Instead of Southwest Africa, it's going to be called Namibia. Instead of Rhodesia, they hope it's going to be called Zimbabwe. And all this sort of thing. If they change the names of people, so what? They do this for nationalistic reasons. But that wouldn't be an important thing to me. Our names are just names. Most Africans have two names anyway. A home name, which is very associated with their culture and tribe, and then a school name, Jim or John or Jack. But I don't think we need to think they're taking away Christianity when they change a name just because of tribalistic or nationalistic cultures. Would you think so, Ed?
Yes,
I'm going
to say we deserve to be children after the names that the author of the book instead of calling us by Western names. I'd like to ask a question on a political level. Now, you stated that the tribalism was as a core of communism, as much as it is of Western civilization, which is probably true, I'm sure it's true, but you also stated that tribalism was only controlled by the gun. But isn't that exactly what communists do? They have a carrot up front and a gun behind. If you don't accept the economic offer, then you're liquidated. So, I don't think the communists have
yes, and the upshot of that is that communists have the advantage over us because they're willing to use the gun to far greater extent than we are. I think this is very valid. Cubans, thank you. Cubans are probably the puppets of Russia, In Angola, there are thousands, 15 or 20,000 of them in Angola, and they're moving in with their families, and they're taking over African land, and they're setting up what we would call a colonial empire. And the communists complain about colonialism, but are practicing this themselves. There are many Cubans along the borders of Rhodesia, along with some Russian officers as well, in these terrorist camps that are here. There are Cubans in Uganda, and they're moving, as Ed says, into a colonial empire themselves. And it's something that we need to watch and be very well aware of. The Cubans are black. Russians are white. So that Cubans are accepted much more easily in Africa than Russians would be. This is part of the rationale behind it. Yes, Brother Jelly?
One of the news magazines recently suggested that in a rather extensive survey that particularly the British were very favorable to and actually encouraged missionary activity in the colonial areas, with perhaps a secondary view that in the long run, if these people could develop an allegiance to Christianity, it would be thought that this might outlast the allegiance they might have had to the home country.